With support from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Landscapes, an exhibition of paintings by David Stratton. Also featuring a bluegrass jam every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom located at 17 East Taylor in downtown Champaign. On the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, WILL Urbana, and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we'll hear about a murder committed in December 1900 in rural Iowa. The victim, a prosperous farmer. His wife was charged with the crime. Was she guilty? Our guests this afternoon are Patricia Bryan and Thomas Wolfe. They have researched the case's record as well as other documents of the day for their book, Midnight Assassin, A Murder in America's Heartland. In addition to being a historical whodunit, the book offers readers a portrait of life in the rural Midwest at the turn of the 20th century. It does something else, too. As the book's description puts it, Midnight Assassin is about the ways that prejudice and fear can influence justice and how people's preconceptions inform the legal process. It is about a woman tried for a crime but punished for her character. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. Patricia Bryan is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina. Thomas Wolfe received an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop. He works as a writing consultant for the Association of American Medical Colleges. Both are graduates of the University of Iowa. Their book, Midnight Assassin, A Murder in America's Heartland, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon. Patricia Bryan, Thomas Wolfe, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. What led the two of you to this desire to go back to this very cold case and approach it as detectives?
Well, it's a story, an actual story, as you said, of Margaret Hossack, who was accused of killing her husband, but it started with a fictional story. I teach, as you said, I'm a professor at the University of North Carolina Law School, and I teach a seminar on law and literature. And one of the works that I've assigned for many years to my students in that class is a short story, A Jury of Her Peers. And the story takes place at the turn of the century in the rural Midwest, and Susan Glasspohl actually was a Davenport, Iowa native. And the story is about a woman who was accused of killing her husband, and Susan Glasspohl says in her memoir that she based this fictional story on a real-life case that she covered for the Des Moines Daily News in 1900. And I always wondered, you know, what was that case? Susan Glasspohl doesn't say the name. So I went back to the microfilms of the newspapers of that day, 1900 Iowa, and found that she was a reporter on this case of Margaret Hossack, who was accused of killing her husband. So that was how we got started, or how I got started.
Yeah, and then your husband got involved.
Yeah, I had listened to Patricia talk about this case, the story of Margaret Hossack and the kind of background to the Susan Glaspell story, and I sort of listened to her as she did her research and worked on a law review article, and the story was incredibly fascinating to me. And after Patricia finished the law review article, I encouraged her to write a book, and others who read the law review article said this story was just too good to stay in a law review article. And so we began doing more research and sort of going back into the case a little further and figuring out how we could tell the story to a broader audience, which is really what we felt the story deserved, that it had the kind of drama and mystery and conveyed a sense of the Midwest in 1900 and rural farm life in 1900 that really touched on many issues that we were interested in and we thought would be interesting to a broad range of readers.
Yeah, and you are so right. There was a point when you realized you were not only looking at a murder case, an old murder case, but you were looking at this pivotal time in our history, in the history of the Midwest. So what questions then were added to those you set out with at that point?
Well, I think initially when I started the research, I was focused on what had actually happened in the case. And I read all of these newspaper articles, and I was also able to locate wonderful sources of primary documents, you know, the grand jury hearing and the trial transcripts and, you know, private memoirs and lots of legal documents. And I was really focused initially on finding, and continued to be, but on finding out what happened that night when John Hossack was killed. But gradually, as Tom and I did the research further, as you say, we started thinking about what was going on in the Midwest at that time and also how this story was told through the generations, not only in the Hossack family, but also how it sort of reverberated through the community, how the community had dealt with the situation, and then how this story and others around it had lasted through time and what issues they raised that were still relevant today. So it became, you know, more than just a whodunit, mm-hmm. To raise issues of real societal importance that we still struggle with now.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to those issues, I think, a little bit later in the interview. But I want to get our listeners involved here in some of the facts of the case. The murdered man, John Hossack, his wife, Margaret, charged with a crime a few days after her husband's death. Tell us how John Hossack was killed.
Well, the victim was a very prosperous and well-respected farmer, as you said, and he had a large farm for that time. He farmed 200 acres in Warren County, Iowa, just south of Des Moines. And we know that he was killed sometime around midnight. He was attacked sometime around midnight, I should say, on December 1st, 1900. He was hit with an axe in the head as he slept, once with the sharp side of the axe and once with the flat side of the axe. He lived, unbelievably, for 10 more hours. He was conscious during part of that time. He spoke. He asked for water for his glasses. He told people he felt cold. But he did not know who had hit him. His wife, Margaret, claimed to be sleeping next to him, and that was her story really from the beginning of the investigation for the rest of her life. She stuck by that story that an intruder had come in the house and attacked her husband. She had heard the door close as the intruder left the house, and then she had called up the stairs to her children, and she had, Margaret and John Hossack had 9 children altogether.
Yeah, they'd been married for 33 years.
They'd been married a long time. They had many children, and 5 of those children lived in the house and the night of the murder. The youngest was 13, a young boy sleeping in the room next to where the murder occurred with one of his brothers, and then there were 3 older children who lived upstairs. So although the attack and the murder occurred in a very rural area of Warren County, there were 7 people, including the victim, in the house on the night of the murder.
Mm. And a dog in the yard.
And a dog who didn't bark, which
right.
became a very important part in the case, because the family dog was known to bark at intruders and bark at people who came into the yard or at stray cattle. And none of the residents of the house, none of the children or Margaret Hossack, heard the dog bark that night, and neighbors who later came to the house were convinced that the dog was acting in a very sluggish manner and thought that the dog had been drugged, which would suggest the presence on the property of an outsider.
That was, of course, what the defense argued, right, that the dog had been drugged. It could have been an outsider. The dog would not have barked because of the chloroform, perhaps. But, of course, the prosecutor said, well, there was no evidence to support that. It must have been someone, a family member, that the dog knew, which was why it didn't bark. The investigators got there the next day, and fairly quickly, despite Margaret Hossack's consistent claims of innocence, they fixed on, first of all, they thought it was someone in the family. There was no sign of a break-in. Nothing was taken. There was no evidence that John Hossack had any enemies in the neighborhood. So they fixed on an insider, someone within the family. And fairly quickly, as they started to talk to neighbors at the coroner's inquest, which began the next day, the investigators started to fix on Margaret Hossack as the most likely suspect. The neighbors talked about a history of trouble between John and Margaret Hossack. It came out that he had been a very threatening presence to his family. It's unclear whether there was physical abuse, but certainly he had threatened his wife and his children with guns and with knives. His wife had talked to the neighbors about her fears for her safety and for that of her family. And that really gave the investigators what they wanted, which was a motive. There was circumstantial evidence to support the possibility of her guilt as well. They had found the family axe not too far from the house with what they thought were blood and hairs on it, so they presumed that that was a murder weapon. And, of course, the story that she had been sleeping in the bed next to him. It was a very small bed. It was what they called at that point a three-quarters bed, which was smaller than a double bed. Her story that she had not been awakened when her husband was hit seemed to them, as you know, you have to admit, it seems to us somewhat incredible. So it made them suspect that she was lying, and then the reports of abuse gave them evidence of a motive.
Yeah. What was the quality of the forensic inquiry?
Well, forensics had not evolved anywhere near what they are today, so there was no DNA testing, of course. They couldn't get fingerprints from the axe, and as it turned out, they couldn't really ascertain whether or not the blood on the axe was human blood or the blood of a turkey that had been killed 2 days before at Thanksgiving. There were hairs taken from the axe as well, but at trial, in the expert testimony, the experts could not agree for certain that the hairs were even human hairs. So although they tried to match the hairs on the axe with the hairs on John Hossack's head, and they had to exhume the body to get that evidence, the evidence, the physical evidence, just was not very convincing. And with modern forensics and techniques, the case probably would have been solved within a matter of days. But in this particular case, evidence in terms of what the neighbors reported and in terms of the circumstantial evidence and the crime scene really had to carry more weight because the physical evidence couldn't be more conclusive.
Mm. And the neighbors knew of this man's temper.
Right.
And they knew there had been fights, and Margaret had spoken of being afraid for herself and the children. But when she is asked during the coroner's inquest, did you and Mr. Hossack ever have any trouble, she answered, no, sir, no more than we might sometimes get out of humor for a little bit, nothing much. Why do you think Margaret Hossack denied that she and her husband had had troubles?
Well, that's a very interesting quote that you bring up, because I remember when I was doing the research on this and first read the transcript for the coroner's inquest, and she was asked these questions, did you talk to Mr. Keller? Did you talk to Mrs. Keller? Did you ever say that you were afraid of your life for your life? All of these conversations that other people reported, she said she denied. She must have known that they would talk to the investigators, and so, of course, you wonder, why did she deny it? I guess it occurred to me a couple of things. One, is there was a sense of shame, I think, that she must have felt about her unhappy and conflicted marriage. And whether she had talked about it earlier, she still, even though she had talked about it earlier, I think she was still very hesitant to talk about it to the authorities. I think she must have felt to some extent that it was her fault. Certainly the neighbors, when they had talked about it with her and the family, had told them private family matters are private. You shouldn't be talking about them with other people. And I think Margaret Hossack, you know, to some extent at the time of the investigation, took that to heart. And, of course, at that point also her husband was dead. And whether she might have had some feeling, well, I shouldn't, you know, talk ill of the dead, or whether she knew that to the extent she talked about the fear that she felt from her husband, or, you know, that he might hurt her, that that might incriminate her. Mm. It's very mysterious to me as well, but whether it was just a sense of family privacy or already a sense that she didn't want to make it, she didn't want to make it worse for her family and for herself.
Yeah, I think in this part of the book, at the outset of a chapter, you have included an epigraph, and forgive me, I don't recall it precisely, but in a small town, you don't utter a bad word in public.
Right. Right. That's a quote from Kathleen Norris.
Kathleen Norris.
Beautifully about the Midwest, especially South Dakota, and about the sense of privacy and the way that secrets are kept in families and in communities in the Midwest. And as Patricia was saying, people tried to resolve difficult matters either within the family or within a very close set of friends and neighbors. And people just didn't want to talk openly the way that people do now on Oprah and on Jerry Springer and on many shows. People kept their private troubles private.
Hmm. Well, I think, you know, even though we have those television shows, I think that there's still, among many families, that there is still this sense of keep family things family.
Oh, I think that's really true, and I think it's something that, you know, agencies who are trying to deal with abuse have to deal with all the time. You know, how do we get people to admit what's going on and to talk about their problems? I think there is often a sense of shame and reluctance and of, you know, a sense that this belongs within the family, even if it clearly is a dangerous situation.
Mm. Well, we talked a little bit about the possibility of the dog being drugged. Were there other suspects? Were there other theories of what had happened? Did John Hossack have any enemies?
Well, we know that he had quarreled with a neighbor who lived a little over half a mile to the north of him, and they had quarreled in public, actually on election day, just 3 weeks before the murder. And this particular neighbor was someone who seemed to be somewhat mentally unstable. In fact, he wound up being put in the state mental institution right before the first trial, so he didn't testify at the first trial. So we know that he had that quarrel with that neighbor, and we also know that John Hossack was involved in land deals and in politics, and that there certainly could have arisen some conflicts between him and his neighbors in some of those dealings.
Although none of that ever came out.
None of it ever came out conclusively, but there was a sense that he was a powerful man in the community and had quarreled sometimes with his neighbors. And we also know that on the night of the murder, there was a mysterious horseman that was spotted riding away from the crime scene about 15 or 20 minutes after the crime had been committed. And this person was never identified, but people in the community did speculate that perhaps that person had been the assailant or had somehow been involved in the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was in the community, and since then, the suspicion that it might have been one of the children.
Mm-hmm.
As well. Certainly John Hossack was a strong taskmaster, and two of his sons had moved away after reported conflicts with their father, and there were three sons living in the house at the time of the murder. So all of those, the two who were away, I should say, did have what seemed to the authorities at the time good alibis. One of them was too far away to have come, and the other one, you know, was at a rooming house, and he was boarding with some neighbors, and he had a good alibi. So he was never suspected officially or named as an official suspect, I should say, although certainly some of the neighbors thought that it could have been one of the sons.
Yeah. You wonder, too, did Margaret, if she was innocent, did she fear that that was, in fact, what had happened?
Yeah.
Or did she know it?
Right. How much did she know?
Right.
Right. And people who we talked to, contemporary residents who have sort of followed the story down for a century, contemporary residents theorized that Margaret knew that her sons would be suspects and that she had a better chance of avoiding being hung or was willing to protect her sons, even though she was the prime suspect. And the truth is she had protected her family members for 20 years from the wrath of her husband, so it's not inconsistent with her personality or with what she might have tried to do at the time to protect her children if she thought one of them was guilty.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Patricia Bryan and Thomas Wolfe, authors of Midnight Assassin, A Murder in America's Heartland. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. When you began your research, you took out an ad in the local paper, the Record Herald and Indianola Tribune, asking for information about the case. Tell us about the response you got to the ad.
Well, right, exactly right. We took out a big ad. It had a big, bold black line around it and a headline, "Who Killed John Hossack?" And then, in smaller print, I described who I was and what I was doing and gave a toll-free number and asked people who knew anything about the murder or, I said, who had stories about life in Iowa around the turn of the century to call me. I got a lot of calls, I have to say. A lot of people were in touch with me. Some of them had ideas about the Hossack murder. They had heard stories about the Hossack murder as they were growing up. One woman had heard her parents arguing about who did it. One person said, "Oh, I know who did it." In fact, I think several said, "I know who did it." But then when we talked about it, they had no definitive evidence. But they had ideas. And it was interesting also talking to people who called because, not surprisingly, people were very suspicious of what my motives were. Why was I looking into this very cold case? Was I trying to clear someone's name? Was I trying to point a finger of guilt at someone else? And I tried to, and Tom and I together, when we visited these people in Indianola, tried to assure them that we were not sensationalizing the murder or even trying to solve it necessarily, but that we wanted to tell the story of the family and the community and really paint a picture of what rural life was like at the turn of the century in this specific place. And once people had a sense of what we were trying to do, they were much more cooperative and eager to talk to us. We heard a lot of interesting stories about families, some of which had nothing to do with the Hossack family at all, but many of which gave us ideas of what it was like to live there. And certainly some of the clues that we received, we talk about in Midnight Assassin. We have a chapter where we talk about that kind of research and include some of the stories we heard.
Mm. And I think one of the remarkable things to both of us was how many different stories have evolved out of this single event. And as it got passed down either through Hossack family descendants, and in our research we tried to talk to as many living descendants of the Hossacks as that we could find, but also from the descendants of neighbors. And, you know, to hear stories from people who said that they were taken as children to the graveyard and shown the Hasek grapes and then told the story, was very, very evocative to us and made us realize that, of course, the stories that came out in court were very limited stories. And even the stories that were in the newspapers at the time were just part of the truth, and that eventually the Fuller story and variants of the Fuller story were passed down orally in a kind of oral tradition through families, and that because the murder was never solved, there were a lot of different theories that evolved over time.
And I'll also say one of an interesting point, and we talk about this a little bit in the book, is that one lawyer that we talked to warned us not to look into this case. He actually said that our lives might be in danger if we got too close to the truth, as he said, that feelings still ran high among the descendants of the families involved. And we didn't stop our search, although we did it with a little bit more caution after that point. And again, tried to convince people we talked to that we had a fairly benign motive in what we were trying to do.
Yeah. Well, now, since the book is out, have you talked with this gentleman, Stephen Hall, since?
We actually haven't talked to him. We sent him a copy of the book and wrote him a note. And I will say he was an extremely gracious man, very, very
knowledgeable about
local history and the history of lawyering in Iowa. And he knows some story that is actually a variant from others that we've heard. So he has a particular story, but it's one that he has decided not to divulge. He feels that he learned it from another lawyer, that it was privileged. And so he gave us enough information to pique our curiosity and keep us looking, but he really has not communicated with us since the book came out.
Interesting. The stories that have come down over the years that are still told in Warren County, are there themes that emerge in these stories?
Well, I think there's a variation of themes. There's the theme of sort of family violence in terms of the murder being committed by a family member to either protect to protect the family from further verbal or physical abuse from John Hasek. And I think there's also a kind of theme that evolves that certain things just can't be known, and that the legal system itself does the best it can to sort of sort things out and assign blame and provide justice in the best way that it can. But I think many people who spoke to us spoke recognizing the fact that there are just some things that cannot be learned, and that this case is going to stay a kind of mystery, and it will intrigue readers, we think, the same way that it's intrigued us as researchers and writers.
Yeah. What are the lessons, do you suppose, for us, as today we follow sensational news stories or are impaneled on a jury in a case that is so sensational?
Well, one lesson, I think, that comes out of it, and of course I'm a lawyer, so I was especially interested in how the lawyers told the stories in the courtroom, and then, of course, how the media and the newspapers picked up those stories. But I think one thing that will resonate with readers of today is how lawyers and the media rely upon and suggest kind of underlying stereotypes of how they expect people to behave and to act, and that often jurors and members of the community make up their minds based on assumptions and biases. It's really interesting when you read the arguments, both for the prosecution and the defense in the Margaret Hasek case. They were really arguing in a certain way about what kind of woman she was. The defense wanted to portray her as a virtuous wife, obedient wife, a loving mother, because they knew that to the extent they could paint her as that kind of woman, the all-male jury, and of course women at this time were not allowed to sit on the jury, the all-male jury would have a harder time convicting her of such a violent crime. They would see her more like their own wives and sisters and daughters, and they certainly didn't want to believe that they were capable of such violence. The prosecution, of course, wanted to paint her as a different kind of woman, not a good mother, not an obedient wife, so that the jurors could decide that she was capable of violence toward her husband. But those suggestions of what kind of woman Margaret Hossack was were not always straightforward. I mean, they came in kind of insinuations and comments that the prosecution and the defense made during their arguments, and I think that still goes on today. I mean, you think about the O.J. Simpson case, for instance, and the way, you know, the defendant and the police officers and the victim are portrayed. Many times the lawyers and the media are trying to sway our judgment based not necessarily on facts, but again on stereotypes and assumptions. And I think that's something that we have to guard against.
I would add to that that one of the interesting things in the Margaret Hossack case that that we found was that the community sentiment changed over time, and that right after a crime is committed, there's sometimes a kind of rush to judgment, a desire to find the person guilty, to punish, particularly if it's a particularly violent crime. And in the communities, in this community in Warren County, Iowa, we found that within a few weeks of the time of the first trial, there were articles in the newspaper suggesting that maybe the evidence wasn't all that clear, and that there was a sense in the community that in order to really have justice, the facts needed to be looked at again, and there was actually a second trial in this case. So I think that, and I think we see that today also in contemporary trials, that the kind of fervor that's aroused right after a crime and sometimes during the trial.
And fear, often, right?
Yeah, drives verdicts that aren't necessarily fair or creates verdicts that aren't necessarily fair, and that we have a system in place now where through an appeals process, those facts can be looked at again. And I think that's a lesson to all of us in terms of judging too quickly or judging without full consideration of the evidence.
Yeah. Patricia, here's a big question.
Uh-oh.
But I think it's a pretty, it's an interesting question, and I don't know if it's answerable or not. Actually, there are two parts to it.
Uh-huh.
Did Margaret receive a fair trial, and what can we say, what can you tell us as a law professor about what constitutes a fair trial?
Well, you know, I'm not a criminal lawyer, I have to admit. Everything I know about criminal law, well, I suppose I did take the course in law school, but I've learned during my research. And I think that trying to say whether she had a fair trial or not is, it turned out the appeals court decided that she had not had a fair trial because, and I think they made good points, the evidence had not been handled properly. And at this point in the evolution of the legal system, investigators and the police, the sheriff, were still very new at establishing a chain of custody and, you know, what they could have people say and when. So there weren't the rights in place or the obligations that there are now. So I think looked at from today's vantage point, it's hard to say that she did have a fair trial, given the way the evidence was handled. What constitutes a fair trial is a really hard question, because even if you have in place all of the obligations and ways that evidence has to be handled and what people are allowed to testify, you're still dealing with the question of who is capable of judging another person. I mean, that was a real problem for Margaret Hossack, that she was supposed to be judged by a jury of her peers, and she was really judged by a jury of her husband's peers. I think we've gone a long way today to try to make the jurors more diverse and more able to hear the defendant's story as well as the victim's story, but I think that, you know, continues to be a real problem. It's so easy to identify with the victim and also, and often the defendant, it's hard to fully understand where the defendant has come from, what the defendant's story is. And I think that was a problem for Margaret Hossack, and it certainly was one of the things that Susan Glaspell picked up on when she wrote A Jury of Her Peers, whether the courtroom could do justice in a case where there was no one who could understand Margaret Hossack's story seated on that jury.
Hmm. How did Susan Glasspell tell Margaret Hossack's story in the reports that she filed from Iowa? Or for, well, she worked for the largest daily in Iowa, the
right.
Daily News. But how did she report the story as it was unfolding?
Well, that's really a fascinating question, because we see through Susan Glasspell's news reports the same kind of evolution of thinking and sentiment that occurred in the community. At first, Susan Glasspell sort of appeared on the scene and reported the crime in really fairly lurid and sensationalistic prose. You know, this man slain with an axe and his wife beating his brains out with an axe.
Yeah, as everybody else was doing, too.
As everybody else was doing. And, of course, you know, as you say, the Des Moines Daily News was the largest daily in Iowa at that time and was competing with another afternoon paper in Des Moines for readers. So the initial reporting was very sensational, very vivid. And we include a lot of those newspaper reports in the book so that readers can see for themselves how they appeared. But once Susan Glasspell had two sort of moments that really changed her view of Margaret Hossack. One was when she visited the Hossack farm and actually walked into Margaret Hossack's kitchen, and she saw in the yard, she saw the bed in which the murder had occurred had been pulled out into the yard. She saw the bloody sheets, and she walked into the kitchen and saw Margaret Hossack's kitchen and imagined what her life was like in that extremely isolated farmhouse surrounded by, you know, 6, 7, 8 children all the time, and this sort of abusive husband. And I think that she became more sympathetic at that point, and we see in her newspaper accounts a more sympathetic portrait of Margaret after that.
Mm.
And then Susan Glasspell saw Margaret Hossack in court coming for hearings and saw her as a relatively sort of frail older woman, you know, who was weeping, and she began to portray her then at that time in a much more sympathetic light also. So we see this evolution in the newspaper accounts that's similar to what eventually occurred in the community.
Yeah. Well, by the time she went to trial, I'm kind of rounding things off here, she was about 60 years old.
That's right, yeah. I think that Margaret was almost 60 years old, and she had, I think, 9 grandchildren, and in the courtroom, she held one of the grandchildren in her, a sleeping grandchild in her arms, so that she was a very different defendant than, say, Lizzie Borden, who was a young, vibrant, well-dressed, attractive woman, and had a very different kind of image to jurors and to people who observed the trial in 1892, the Lizzie Borden trial.
What was daily life like for Margaret on the farm?
Well, that's one of the things that we do try to portray in the book, and it was interesting as we did our research into rural life at the turn of the century to read. We read a lot of diaries and memoirs of farm women, to read about the crushing overwork that they were expected to do. I mean, it was physically overwhelming. And it was made worse, I think, by the fact that they were very isolated. Farm women were much more isolated than farm men, because the farm men at least went to town to transact business and to help each other on their farms. Farm women tended to stay at home with their brood of children. So they were isolated, and of course they often weren't appreciated. As one reviewer said, they were treated worse than draft animals, I think. But they weren't appreciated for what they did. Of course, they were also either nursing or pregnant or recovering from pregnancy. Margaret Hossack had 10 children, 9 of whom lived to adulthood. But during the first 20 years of her marriage, the last child she had when she was age 44. Now, it's true that the older children could help with the farm work, and certainly did, but there was always, you know, children running around, and then the preparation of meals and the laundry and the washing up. They ironed, if you can imagine, they ironed the bed sheets summer and winter, and just trying to keep the house clean was an unbelievable amount of physical labor for these women, as I say, who were often either pregnant or nursing or recovering from pregnancy. So the death rate you know, women died fairly young in that day, and certainly were often not in good health. Margaret Hossack, I think, was in surprisingly good health in her late 50s. But it is one of the things that was most impressive to me as we did the research. It wasn't the pastoral, good life that is often portrayed in romantic fiction, but just the Midwest rural life was incredibly hard for women and men, I should say.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to this very fascinating character that is here in the pages of your book, and who this case really affected her very much, and it's somebody we've talked about already, Susan Glasspell. This is very interesting. Now, she's a young woman working for the largest daily in Iowa. I think she was 22 years old when she began to cover the Hossack case, but before she wrote those articles for the paper, she wrote columns for the paper that, quote, derided social conventions and customs that tended to stereotype women or limit their aspirations. Can you give us an example or two of what Susan Glasspell was writing and how those columns were seen in Iowa?
Well, I think that some of what Glasspell wrote in those columns was somewhat tongue-in-cheek, and I think maybe only a 20th century audience can really appreciate what Glasspell was perceiving in terms of the roles of men and women around 1900. Glasspell had started off as a kind of society reporter in her hometown of Davenport and felt like she had to report on, you know, the goings-on of women's clubs and various clubs and organizations in town. And when she got to Des Moines, after she went to Drake University and graduated from there and got this job in the newspaper there, she was still writing and being assigned to write columns that she thought were relatively sort of fluff pieces, but that she seemed to sense that the differences between men and women were more extreme, and it was something that she later in her career, when she became a fiction writer in the early 1900s, she began to really address more forcefully in terms of themes the differences between men and women and the way that women's lives were constrained by not having education, by having children and being wedded to the home. And I think that she was really a feminist about 100 years ahead of her time.
Right.
And that began to come out in her fiction and then in her plays in a very powerful and dramatic way. I mean, she was one of the foremost American writers of the first half of the 20th century. And her work now really is just being rediscovered. And if you go all the way back to her newspaper columns in 1898 in Davenport, you see the beginning of those more radical sensibilities.
Right.
Mm. Would you recommend her memoir?
The Road to the Temple is really a wonderful memoir, primarily about her husband, Jig Cook, and about the beginning of the Provincetown Players. Susan Glasspell was such a force in American theater because of the influence she and her husband had in forming the Provincetown Players, and then Susan Glasspell especially was a very powerful influence on Eugene O'Neill and brought him really to the American stage. So. Wow. The Road to the Temple is a very good book, and there's a new biography of Susan Glasspell written by Linda Benz-Vee, which tells Susan Glasspell's life in detail, which I would recommend to all Midwestern readers.
Yeah. Well, that's fabulous that she's coming back again, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. She won the Pulitzer Prize?
Well, she did. She won the Pulitzer Prize for a play, Allison's House, and actually a jury of her peers, this short story, was selected just recently, a couple of years ago, by John Updike for inclusion in the best 100 short stories of the last century, and then by Tony Hillerman in the best mystery stories of the last century. So she was very popular during her day. She was on the bestseller list of the New York Times. But then she kind of fell into obscurity. And partly because she does focus so much, I think, on internal experiences of women and obstacles that women face in trying to realize their ambitions. And I think during the 50s, that was less popular, 40s and 50s. But she really has been rediscovered by women's studies professors first and then students. And that rediscovery has really led to a new appreciation of her life and her skill.
Mm. Okay, listeners, we have some reading suggestions now. Midnight Assassin, The Road to the Temple, and the new biography of Susan Glasspell. We have to wrap up here. We've used up the time. It went so quickly. Patricia, Brian, Thomas, Wolf, thank you so much for being my guests this afternoon.
Oh, it was great. Thank you,
Celeste. Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Very
much. Take care. Thank you very
much.
Midnight Assassin, A Murder in America's Heartland, published by Algonquin Books off Chapel Hill. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Jay Pierce.
All right. Thank you very much, Celeste. And September wheat had a high price of 334.5, a low of 327.5. The settlement, 327.75, down 5.25. December wheat had a high of 348, a low of 342. The settlement was 342.25, down 4.75 today. March 06 wheat had a high of 361, a low of 354. The settlement, 354.5, down 5. May wheat had a high of 364.5, a low of 360. The settlement, 361, down 4.5. And July 06, the high today, 370, the low, 365. The settlement, 365.5. July 06 wheat ending up the day down 2.5. In the corn pits, September corn had a high of 242, a low of 236. The settlement, 236.5, down 4.5. December, 252.5 was the high. The low was 248. The settlement, 248.25, down 4.25. March had a high of 260, a low of 255. The settlement, 255.5, down 4. May corn, 263 for the high. 259.5 was the low. The settlement, 259.75, down 3.75. July 06, the high, 267.25, the low, 263. The settlement, 263.5, down 4. And September 06, corn had a high of 261, a low of 259.5. The settlement, 260, down 1.5. September oats had a high of 168.75, a low of 162.5. A settlement at 162.75, down 5.75. December, 173.5 for the high. The low is 168.5. Settlement at 169.75, down 3.5. August soybeans had a high of 686, a low of 667. The settlement 671.75, down 12.5. September, the high 692, the low 672.5. The settlement 677, down 12. November soybeans had a high of 701, a low of 681. The settlement 686.75, down 11.5. January beans had a high of 704, a low of 685. The settlement 691, down 10.75. March, a high of 697, the low 682. The settlement 688, down 9.5. May soybeans had a high of 691, the low 676. Settlement 681.5, down 7.5. And July 06 beans, 688 was the high, the low 677. The settlement 683, down 3.5. August soybean meal had a high of 216.80, a low of 211. The settlement 212.40, down 340. September, the high 216.50, the low 210.20. The settlement 210.60, down 450. And August soybean oil had a high of 24.55, a low of 24.20. The settlement 24.31, down 19. September oil, 24.60 was the high, the low 24.30, settlement 24.33, down 25. And now with a look at how things came out on the Mercantile Exchange, it's back to you, Celeste.
Okay, thank you, Jay. Everything was up today on the Mercantile Exchange, the contracts that we keep track of, with the exception of August pork bellies. They finished down $2. August feeder cattle, the high today 109.40, the low 107.70, the settlement 109.22.5, that up 165. September 107.75, the high 105.95, the low 107.45, the settlement that up 162.5. October 106.70, the high, the low 105 even, the settlement 106.67.5, that up 165. August live cattle 81.30, the high 79.60, the low 81.20, the settlement that up 162.5. And October live cattle, 83.50 the high, 82 even the low, 83.40 the settlement, that up 135. August lean hog, 67.92.5 the high, the low 67.15, the settlement 67.87.5, that up 60. October 57.90 the high, 56.95 the low, 57.52.5 the settlement, that up 67.5. December lean hogs, 55.75 the high, 55.05 the low, 55.65 the settlement, that up 57.5. February lean hogs, 58.25 the high, 57.85 the low, the settlement 58.22.5, that up 27.5. August bellies, 79.15 the high, 77.20 the low, and the settlement, that down $2. The Dow is off 25 points at 10,681. The NASDAQ off 9 at 2189. The S&P 500 off 5 at 1239.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Martha Barron from Seattle, Washington wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, on the back side of my computer, there are numerous holes and sockets that have nothing plugged into them. What is their function and purpose?
Those are air vents to rid the computer of excess silicon monoxide, a poisonous gas produced as a product of computing. Unless you're doing a lot of number crunching, the gas won't build up to a sufficient concentration to kill you, although breathing even a microscopic amount may encourage you to become morbidly preoccupied with past humiliations, failed relationships, and to find yourself revolting when you look in the mirror. You can plug those holes with silica gel if you wish to avoid such brooding, or you could stick straws into them and point them toward your face if that's your idea of a good time.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Dex Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Dex Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD, featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
With advances in fertility treatments, women can now become pregnant in their 50s and beyond, so doctors are debating a need for age limits.
We really weren't comfortable as clinicians saying we have complete control over who's allowed to raise a child and who isn't.
A medical and ethical dilemma. At what age is a woman too old for childbirth? That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580.